Well, what a strange couple of days it's been in Dublin, Brussels and Frankfurt. Months of intense and complex negotiations on our promissory notes ended in a deal that will cut the country's borrowing needs by 20 billion in the coming decade. There was confirmation that the deal had been done around lunchtime yesterday, following an overnight session of the Dáil to agree the liquidation of the failed Anglo-Irish Bank, now known as IBRC. The Seanad approved the legislation just before 6 a.m. and President Michael D. Higgins signed it into law an hour later. A few sparse and low-key words from ECB President Mario Draghi signalled success for the government negotiators. The European Central Bank, he said, unanimously took note of the Irish operation. Well, with me now is the Minister for Finance, Michael Noonan. Minister, good morning and welcome.
Good morning, Pat, and thank you.
How did you feel? I mean, was it like Ireland winning the Six Nations?
Well, we've been negotiating this actively since late September. And we've had many occasions when we were at the brink of a successful conclusion. So when it finally concluded around lunchtime yesterday, I had a great sense of relief.
Was it euphoria, though, as well?
No. Just a sense of relief that we had actually delivered it. It's very significant, the fact that there's 20 billion we won't be borrowing over the next 10 years does a lot for Ireland. And it's already reflected in the markets last night and this morning. Irish interest rates have dropped significantly. And that's probably the most crucial thing, because if we can continue with lower interest rates, then there will be more investment in the country. We'll get the economy growing. We'll get people back to work. And we'll get out of this dreadful phase in our national life and back into normality with a growing economy and normal life standards for our people.
Okay, now we've heard about the 1 billion difference it will make to the budgetary calculations and how you decide to spend that. We might come in a moment to spend it or save it. In terms of existing debt, we know we're in a bailout program where the conditions are fixed, and we hope to exit that and be back in the markets. But in terms of historical debt, does any of this make a difference? That the fact that the markets are treating our bonds more kindly, does it make any difference to those contributions we have to make at the moment?
See, the amount of debt, like in a household, is one issue, but the real issue is the ability to pay it.
Yeah.
And if on this this deal now, we won't be paying the 3.1 billion at the end of March or next March or any other March.
But are there savings on the existing debt that we make? Because
there's no write-down on the debts, because write-downs on the debts are not available from the European Central Bank. Even Greece, at its lowest point, when they negotiated significant write-downs, only were allowed write-downs from the private investors in Greece. They got nothing of a way of discount from the European
Central
Bank.
Does it gall you, though, that we didn't succeed in doing that with the private investors, the bondholders in the pillar banks, which we'll come to in a few minutes, but also in Anglo, that every bondholder pretty much got paid?
Well, when I recapitalised the banks just after coming into government in March of 2011, I spent all one morning on regular phone calls to Jean-Claude Trichet, who was the governor of the ECB at the time. And I pressed him very hard, and he pressed back even harder. But our policy position all the time going into the budget is that we would like to burden share with the senior bondholders, but we could only do that by agreement with the ECB. And they wouldn't agree. But the situation...
Did you explain why? I mean, in Greece, they actually really pressed hard on the private bondholders, and they achieved several deals over the time period to get them to take a haircut. Why were they so reluctant to allow the Irish government to give a haircut to their bondholders? Was it because they were French and Germans?
Well, first of all, we were in a much better position than Greece. And,
but there's a principle here, that if you're going to give them a haircut...
They allowed us to write off the subordinated bondholders, but there's a ranking order of debt, and the subordinate bondholders were burned, and it was worth about 15 billion to the Irish Exchequer. So it's not true to say that there weren't write-downs. There was a write-down of about 15 billion. But on the senior debt, that ranks high, and to move unilaterally on that would be a default, and defaults hang around for an awful long time. Look at Argentina. The president of Argentina, in the last couple of weeks, wasn't able to use her government jet to fly out of Argentina, because if she landed in any other country, the people that they defaulted on over 10 years ago would confiscate the jet. That was the threat. They had a sailing ship equivalent to our Asgard, one of these tall sail ships, mm-hmm. and it sailed into a West African port in the late autumn, and it was confiscated by a hedge fund, and their default was a way back. And, you know, so default is a kind of a throwaway line, but it has enormous consequences, and it affects everybody. What we have to do is ensure that we can afford our debt, that people who have personal debt will get deals to make their debts affordable, and that we can continue to build our country. We're growing now. We'd like to grow stronger, and this will help our growth strategy.
The enormous amount of personal debt, which you've adverted to there, that is one of the big problems. I mean, even within the domestic economy, people are put to the pin of their collars to pay mortgages which are disproportionate now to the value of their homes. Can't be spending in the local shops.
That's right. That's one of the big problems in the economy.
So what are we to do? Because this one-to-one, we'll talk to your bank and they look after you. Maybe they might do a deal with you. In Iceland, they had a structural thing. They said, if you have a house, you owe, what was it, 120% or 110% of the market value of the house at this point. End of story. Very attractive idea for the punter.
Yes, but, you know, they have a different type of economy and you can't transfer schemes from one different economy to another. But the position in Ireland is the Alan Chatter has got the personal insolvency bill through now. That provides the base. The banks all through the autumn have been training extra staff. Bank of Ireland, AIB, for example, have trained between 400 and 500 people to act on a case-by-case basis to do deals with people. They tell me in AIB now that they're positioned to do between 1,500 and 2,000 arrangements per month. So the thing is moving now at last, and people can look to the future with hope. As well as that, we're in a space now where the number of mortgages in distress that are being notified to the banks has decreased. So, you know, you can say now what the full number that will have to be dealt with is, and the banks are planning. But we'll drive them forward. I mean, we monitor them all the time.
The central bank was very critical of the banks and their tardiness.
That's right. They were very slow to get off the ground. And, you know, a lot of the time was because they didn't have the staff. You see, in the good times, they were pretty well handing out money without any great scrutiny. And when it came then to evaluating people's capacity to pay, they were very scarce on personnel with that skill set and negotiating skill set. But they've trained a lot of people now, so it will get better. If somebody doesn't have an arrangement, that are listening to us this morning and they find it impossible to pay their mortgage, they should ring whoever lent them the money in the first instance and say, we want to start talking about this.
Michael Noonan sent me.
You can, you can say Pat Kenny sent me, or Michael Noonan sent me, but get into talks.
Going back to the deal that was done, you said there was many a slip twixt cup and lip. It almost didn't happen, then it almost happened, and then it didn't happen again. Because they had this business of a monetary financing of countries by their own central banks kind of thing, and via the ECB, that they weren't going to allow it. What changed?
What changed was that we took the negotiation piece by piece, and stuff like liquidating IBRC and transferring the assets to NAMA, we had that agreed in the middle of the autumn. And that's why I was able to act so quickly when the story went out.
But the ECB had agreed that with you. You had told them about your plan.
This was all part of the package. And, you know, the Attorney General had provided me with a stamped copy of the legislation necessary way back before Christmas.
So that was in place. But still they
and
were
we had our conversations with KPMG, so we knew that we had a liquidator to go in, and they had a staff ready. And it's amazing in a small town that it remained confidential for so long, because they had to brief a lot of people, because IBRC Anglo have property and offices in London and New York as well. So when we signed the order at 4 o'clock the day before yesterday, KPMG had to put people in London and in New York Dublin to secure the assets. And you couldn't do that without the pre-planning. So in terms of the negotiation, all those bits were uncontentious.
Okay, so what changed? Why did the ECB then change its mind about the whole principle of this, which I think was described, Philip Boucher-Hayes reported from Frankfurt, or he was talking to people in Frankfurt, they described as barely legal.
Well, I don't think that's right. You see, the legal people would say that the existing promissory note arrangement was totally contrary to
So that was illegal?
Totally, you know. So my argument all the time was...
So it's an improvement in its legality?
Yeah, I mean, some of the bank people were saying to me, look, what you're saying is illegal. And it's an awful lot more legal than what you agreed 3 years ago. But
Megan Green, by the way, last night on RT Radio said from America, she was talking, she said it's amazing how many things in the EU or the Eurozone are illegal until someone does them and then they become okay.
Yeah, there's a touch of that about it. But really, the issue was this idea of monetary financing. And effectively that means that unlike the Bank of England or the Fed in the United States, the European Central Bank can't print money. They call it quantitative easing is the fashionable. Yeah. It was printing money and putting into circulation to increase the money supply. They're forbidden from doing that for historic reasons. Remember the stories about people with wheelbarrows full of Deutschmark in the 30s in Germany. And that's in the German psyche, because not only did it collapse their economy, it led to the rise of Hitler. And the greatest disaster that ever happened in German history can be traced back to the fact that their central bank didn't control inflation at the time and that they were printing money to meet their needs. So it's absolutely anathema to the modern bankers in Germany. And, you know, we had to place it in a situation where whatever the deal was, that the bonds that we used to replace the promissory note had to be marketable.
And was that the key change? Was that the key concession from you? You wanted the Irish Central Bank to hang on to these bonds for as long as possible, for a very good reason, because the profits they would make on the interest in these bonds would accrue after expenses, the cost of the money, etc., to the Irish state, which gave you a net interest rate of about 1%, which is very, very cheap.
That's right.
And as long as they were held in the central bank, that would be the case. Once they flogged off the bonds, of course, those profits would accrue to the new bondholders.
That's partly correct. But really, there's a difference between the theory and the practice. And to make the thing legal from the ECB point of view, the theory was quite important. So, for example, the bonds are not in the investment portfolio of the Irish Central Bank. They'll be held in their trading portfolio. But then the decision to sell or not will be vested in the governor of the bank, and he will decide to sell after measuring what effect the sale might have on the stability of the Irish banking system.
But you've got to put some on the market. I mean, was that the thing that unlocked the deal, that you said, OK, we will sell $500 million of these in 2014?
It's very hard to know what actually unlocked it. You know, because everybody was looking at the deal overall. But certainly the decision to clearly say that the bonds are marketable and then to agree to selling small quantities of them going forward. But you see, then they decided to compensate us again on that, because you remember last year when we didn't pay the promissory note, we replaced it with an Irish government bond. And that's in the possession now of Bank of Ireland. And we'd have to redeem that in June because they're holding it for 1 year.
At a cost of 3.1 billion.
But what the bank did when they were pressing us to sell early, they also agreed to roll that in with the basket of bonds. So the 25 billion of government bonds would go up to over 28.5. And because that the interest rate on that is 5.4, and because the maturity is very is short relative to the rest of the portfolio, the governor will be able to sell slices of that to meet our requirements to sell up front. So, like, we didn't lose anything off the main deal because they kind of compensated us by allowing us to include the bond in the possession of the Bank of Ireland in the overall portfolio.
The ECB unanimously taking note. Now, this is a term which is the most conservative term you could possibly imagine for giving approval to something. What does it mean?
Well, the theory and the legal position is that this arrangement is an arrangement between the Irish Central Bank and the Irish government, and that the European Central Bank would have a role as guidance and consultants and oversight. So what he's saying is, we see now that there's an arrangement being made in Ireland between the Irish Central Bank and the Irish government, and we note it, and it's noted unanimously.
But does it mean we're watching you, and we're watching you very carefully, or does it mean, that's fine?
It's just their way of putting things. They're saying that's fine, yeah.
A couple of years back, you were on Prime Time with Colin McCarthy, and he, what did he say, that it might, this whole process in trying to get debt restructuring and so on might involve a little broken field rugby. And you, it appears, smiled at the time because you understood the term.
Yes.
Is that what this involved, being creative in when the opposition is scattered right across the field, you've got the ball and you've got to be creative?
Yeah, there was a bit of that about it. And we have a lot of friends internationally now, you know. And Mario Draghi was in favour of our position all the time and told me on several occasions, I want to help Ireland, but I have to act in accordance with law and my legal mandate, but we'll do our best and we'll keep talking and we'll get it fixed. And there's another guy there whose name wouldn't be well known in Ireland, Jörg Asmussen. He used to work with the German finance minister, and then he got promoted to the number two position in the European Central Bank. He was extraordinarily helpful, and I didn't know him, but after being in Berlin to talk to Wolfgang Schäuble, we had a discussion, and he said, look, there's an EU meeting in Cyprus, and I'll make an appointment for you with Asmussen, because he had worked as his chief of staff. And I said to Wolfgang, will you come to the meeting with us? So he did. So the three of us met, and that's really what set the ball rolling. From then on, we had a serious negotiation. So the name that the Irish people don't know is Jörg Asmussen. He was extraordinarily helpful to us.
When the news broke through Reuters on Wednesday afternoon that the IBRC was going into liquidation, how panicked did you get? Now, you were ready. You had the legislation ready to go. But were you truly ambushed by this? Because the conspiracy theorists would say, no, this was all, it was choreographed.
No, there were a couple of occasions previously where our press office got very acute inquiries, and we thought that the story was out. So we had put a contingency in place because we got a serious fright before Christmas. We thought the thing had broken. And our biggest problem was that we couldn't take the board of IBRC or Alan Jukes into confidence, because as directors, if we told them that there was a liquidation imminent, they would have legal obligations to inform all interested parties. And if they didn't, they'd be under pain of a criminal offence and they'd be disqualified from ever holding a directorship again.
And if you'd acted unilaterally, by the way, without the final detail being put in place with the approval of the ECB, what would have happened then? Suppose you had to do it before Christmas, before you had a deal, you had to go and liquidate IBRC.
We'd be kind of halfway across the river with no guarantee that we'd reach the other bank, and it would be a very uncomfortable place to be. Because, to liquidate IBRC and to transfer the assets to NAMA without having an arrangement on the promissory note would put you in a position where you are incurring potential costs with no gain. And it would be a very vulnerable political position, whatever about the financial position.
But to clarify, if this deal was to be done yesterday, and in the event it was... Well, two questions. First of all, if you hadn't been forced into the liquidation of IBRC, do you think that the ECB might have kicked this can down the road another month to bring it closer to the March deadline for the promissory notes?
When we moved to put the special person into IBRC and then change his legal status to that of a liquidator, when those decisions were the day before yesterday, I thought we were going to have a deal by tea time. Everything had been put in place as we thought. But they decided not to conclude and to discuss it again over dinner. You know, they have a two-day meeting and they have a formal meeting. Then they all meet for dinner the following day to have another formal meeting.
But if you hadn't been forced by the leak to do it, would you, do you think it would have gone on another month, or do you think it was imminent anyway? It was going to happen?
I mean, I thought I'd get it the day before. And then I got very concerned.
So it was always going to be February, not March?
Oh, it was always going to be February. We made it very clear to them. You see, March doesn't suit us politically because you know the tradition of selling Ireland across the world around Patrick's Day. So a lot of key ministers, including the Taoiseach and the Taoiseach, would be out of the country for that middle period in March. And I made it very clear to Mario Draghi that we needed this by February.
Now,
March was a space where it didn't suit us politically.
And the promissory note was due at the end of March anyway.
And so then you get painted into a corner.
Yeah.
You know, if things are too close to the finishing line, you know, things can go seriously wrong. So we needed a bit of time. So I impressed on him that it was February. But the relationships are very good now. I mean, Mario Draghi has been extraordinarily helpful on this. And I understood his legal constraints and I understood his need to be able to present that this wasn't monetary financing. So.
No, he yesterday said it's up to Ireland then to kind of do what it chooses. They're not going to tell us how to spend the money. The Troika may try to tell us what to do with the money. Do you think freedom, total freedom, coming up to December's budget to, and I'm not asking you to discuss budgetary secrets because they're only way down in the pipeline at the moment. But what's your instinct? Is it to ease off on the austerity?
My instinct is that the point we have to get to is to get the deficit below 3% by 2015. And in the space between now and then, we have $1 billion now that we won't have to raise in taxes or get by way of expenditure cuts. Now, how we use that, whether we leave it at the end to arrive at the destination sooner and have a kind of a free run for the last budget, or whether we include bits of it up front. But there's an awful lot of variables. We're only on the first week of February. If you look at the January Exchequer returns, income tax went up, receipts went up by 10%. Now, we didn't in either budget increase income tax in any way whatsoever. So a 10% rise means that there are either more people working, or those at work are working longer hours are getting more money. And, they're not all going to leave the workforce in February.
But there's an element, though, of when the payday occurs, isn't there, in terms
No, this would be
even
fairly,
discounting for that.
Yeah, this would be a fairly sound figure now. So, like, there are signs in the economy that things are getting better.
I
would hope that, the lower interest rates running for this now from the deal will give us another bit of boost in the economy, and that'll kick back into the budgetary receipts.
We still have, of course, the massive banking debt, which became sovereign debt when we invested in AIB and Bank of Ireland. It's interesting, the president of the European Parliament, Martin Schulz, had this to say.
The burdens Ireland took at the moment avoided a complete crash of the European banking system, and therefore the Irish need and deserve the solidarity of the Europeans and the European institutions.
Now, that's interesting. He's saying, he's acknowledging that Ireland basically saved the European banking system. I know eaten bread is often said to be soon forgotten, and we mustn't forget the bread that we got from the ECB. But straight away, you're into the next phase, aren't you?
Well, we're into the next phase. We're in the next phase already. But it will take a while because it will run in tandem with the arrangements to have a European banking, united banking system. And it will be in that context that the next bit.
There's how widespread is the view that Martin Schulz expressed there, that Ireland did bail out Europe's banks, was unlucky enough to be the first country to fail, and therefore took the burden of saving the banking system? It might have been Spain, it might have been somebody else.
A lot of people would share the view that Ireland was the first mover and that the policy instruments weren't available in Europe to assist Ireland, so the Irish taxpayer took the full burden. But it can be overstated as well, because if we never had a banking debt, we're spending away more than we're raising in taxes. So, like, there are two problems. There's the debt, a lot of which ran from the banks, but there's also the debt because we're financing ourselves with deficits every year. And even with all the improvements made, there's going to be a deficit next year of about $10 billion, which we'll have to borrow to make up again.
Yeah, where do you see the problem lying principally? I mean, you can look at numbers, and numbers are being reduced. But if you go back to the early 2000s, when we were prospering, we had fewer people working in various areas like education and health, but we were balancing our budget. So where is the extra that's that is now being spent? I mean, again, you can't give, say, pensioners money and then say we're taking it back. You can't give widows money and then say we're taking it back.
It's very difficult, but it's not really that there's extravagant spending now that there wasn't before. It's that the taxes have fallen away, because when the boom in the building industry was over, all the transaction taxes like stamp duty and the VAT and all the rest of it, and then 250,000 people lost their jobs between 2008 and 2010. 250,000. And all the income tax that we're paying and all the PRSI that we're paying went out of the system. So it's not that spending went up, it's the taxes fell away. And you got this huge mismatch then between what we were collecting in taxes and what we were actually spending. And that's the deficit. And if you try to close it in 1 year, you shut the country down. So that's why we needed the bailout program, so that you can spread it over a number of years.
A couple of things, and this has been the view articulated reiterated by Piers Doherty yesterday, talking about his child who wasn't even born at the time the promissory notes were invented and will be 44 before they're done being paid for. Dear Michael Noonan, my daughter is 11 years old and still in primary school. She wants to be a Garda. If she achieves her goal and joins the Garda force and retires at 50, she will have spent her entire working life paying for yesterday's decision.
No, yesterday's decision eases the burden on everybody. Because, first of all, there's no promissory note of $3.1 billion to be paid this March, next March or any March. There will be no capital to be repaid until the bonds mature. No capital payments whatsoever until 2038. And the last capital repayments will be in the 2050-something, 53. But what happens usually in sovereign debt like that, when it comes up to the point of repayment, you roll it over. You refinance it. Most sovereign debt never gets repaid.
But the general principle, though, because of Anglo and the other banks, we are passing on to our children burdens that they will, excessive burdens that they will have to bear. We're told that we have €9,000 per head of a banking burden to carry. The average in Europe for the banking collapse is €125.
Yeah, but you know, that these are interesting statistics, but every country has debt. If you look at a country like the United States, they have enormous amount of debt now, and per capita, it's frightening. But that's not the way the world works. If you can sustain the debt, and if the country can grow, then that lady who rang you in with her 11-year-old, she'll have a very long career in the Guards and she won't be worrying about promissory notes or debt if we can get this right. And it's improving every month and we'll continue driving at it.
I suspect she won't be retiring at 50 either.
Well, I wouldn't think so.
All right. Minister Michael Noonan, thank you very much for joining us in studio this morning.